voting agreements. This is Brock.
And it's John.
So maybe this is one of the few phrases that are self-explanatory, but what are voting agreements?
Well, they are. They're an agreement to vote your shares in favor of a merger and against any competing transaction, typically. They're kind of a lockup. Typically involve major shareholders and insiders of a corporation that's doing a deal.
And when are they installed during the life cycle of a deal?
These are signed up at the time the merger agreement is entered into, either right at that time, or there may be a short period, a window where folks will be asked to sign them. But it's something that is they're a deal protection, they're a lockup arrangement, and they're put in place at the time you enter into the deal.
How common are they?
I think they're pretty common, particularly when there's the ability to get a meaningful number of shares signed up. It's also pretty common to have all the targets, directors, and executive officers sign them, even if there aren't a lot of shares involved. Sometimes can be difficult to typically you'll get as many shareholders as you can. In-house major shareholders, people that, if you've got institutions that have holdings out there, index funds or what have you, that may be more difficult to consider getting a voting agreement out of those entities. But the extent that you've got big individual shareholders or private equity or somebody that's got a big stake in the company, you're going to be looking to get those folks signed on the dotted line.
How about the SEC's view on these things?
They tolerate them, generally speaking. There are some strings attached to that statement. These could potentially raise gun jumping issues under the Securities Act when you think about it. If you're, Rule 145, you're doing a stock for stock deal, you're making an investment decision when you vote your shares. And if you agree to vote your shares, the SEC says, hey, that looks like you're making an investment decision to us. Similar issues under the proxy rules. But the staff tolerates these things. There's typically three conditions you have to satisfy. You can only get these things from executive officers, directors, their affiliates, other insiders, their family members are okay, and then holders of 5% or more of the voting equity of the company that you're going to buy. The person signing up the agreements have to own less than 100% of the voting equity, and you have to solicit the votes from the other shareholders involved in the transaction. Another issue that you have to keep in mind is whether the voting agreements convey beneficial ownership of the underlying shares for purposes of 13D. Some practitioners and treaties have taken the position that granting authority to vote on a specific matter, like voting for a merger agreement, as opposed to right to, say, elect a board of directors, et cetera, give a blanket proxy, doesn't convey beneficial ownership. And I've seen folks take that position with the SEC fairly recently, but I've also seen the SEC issue comments on that topic and not be willing to back down from that position. And the problem there is, if the buyer is acquiring a beneficial ownership interest that's reportable under 13D, then it's got to disclose detailed information about its plans and proposals for the company, including those that it might have post-closing. So it can be a little bit of a sensitive issue as to whether or not you've got a 13D type of reporting issue as a result of signing up these things. But I think many times, and most of the deals I've been in, people have taken the position that, yeah, in fact, a voting agreement is likely to be something that you'll sign up for a reporting obligation for.
And litigation over these things, does that happen a lot?
Well, not in recent years, but when they've been litigated, it's been a very big deal. There was a lot of litigation surrounding shareholder voting agreements and how far you could go to lock up a deal in the early part of the last decade. And the most famous case of that, which everybody has studied in law school by now, if you weren't practicing back then, but if you were, you certainly know it, and that's Omnicare versus NCF Healthcare, where the Delaware Supreme Court said that a target company's directors couldn't agree to a totally locked-up deal without an effective fiduciary out mechanism baked into it. What particularly troubled them was that the principal shareholders of the company had entered into a voting agreement that covered enough shares to ensure the outcome of the vote, where the target had committed to a force the vote clause, and that essentially made shareholder approval of that deal a fait accompli, and the Supreme Court didn't like that. And after Omnicare, people started revising, tweaking their voting agreements to address these things. There was a case called Orman versus Coleman that upheld one that didn't guarantee that a deal was going to get done, but instead the controlling shareholder was required to vote against another deal for 18 months. So there was essentially a tail period where another competing transaction would be blocked, and the Delaware court said that was okay. In private company settings, you've sort of seen these things morph into sign and consent arrangements where majority shareholders execute consents. When companies can act by majority written consent, which they typically can in Delaware unless you've opted out of it, as a way to do an end run around Omnicare. One other thing I want to point out about these things from a litigation or regulatory standpoint is these sometimes raise issues under state takeover statutes. Control share acquisition statutes sometimes kick in if beneficial ownership of more than 20% or so of the outstanding shares is acquired. So in states with these statutes, you'll often see people agree to some sort of a cap on the number of the shares that are subject to the agreements.
Great stuff. Thanks.
You're welcome.